Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The song is Porcelain, one of the many hit singles from the 1999 album Play. That album made Moby a household name. It sold over 12 million copies, but even more important, the music on it would be licensed repeatedly in high-profile movies and TV shows. But Play wasn't the beginning of Moby's career. He'd been a pretty successful figure on the electronic dance music scene, a master of techno, but also of slower, chilled-out electronics. Porcelain is also the name of Moby's new memoir, which, in typically idiosyncratic fashion, covers those early years and stops just as he begins writing the song Porcelain. Now, that's the kind of thing you want to hear an explanation of, and you're about to. This episode of Soundcheck was recorded at Barnes & Noble on Union Square in Manhattan.
This book is not the first time you've told us a story. I mean, you know, you've done that in some of the, like Last Night, for example. That album takes us, it's not the kind of literal narrative of a book, but You've told us stories before.
That record Last Night, that was the record I made right before I got sober. So that's basically a record of alcoholic dysfunction. You know, that's a record of finding bags of drugs behind the toilet at Max Fish at 3 o'clock in the morning. Max Fish is gone, too. And doing them no matter what they were. So there was just, like, a level of gritty degeneracy and dysfunction around that record. This book, hopefully, has some grittiness and dysfunction, but not nearly as immersive as that record was.
Every day, it's 1989 from Moby's album Last Night, which takes you through an entire night from dusk to dawn. And we're taking you through a conversation with Moby about his memoir called Porcelain on Soundcheck.
So, that record comes about 10 years after this book ends. I mean, this book basically takes us through the 90s, right?
Starts in 1989 when I was squatting in an abandoned factory in a crack neighborhood in Stamford, Connecticut. And it ends roughly around the time that the album Play was released. So it's 89 to 99. And I liked the idea of ending at what arguably or ostensibly would be the beginning of the more sort of conventionally known narrative.
Right, which suggests a second volume is going to have to
Well, here's the thing.
I've
tried to write the second book. The problem is the second book is just degeneracy and darkness and a descent towards ultimate sobriety. Unfortunately, that story's been written by a lot of musicians already. And so I'm trying to figure out how do I write it in a way that doesn't make it sound like a Duff McKagan book or an Eric Clapton book. I mean, because like, it should have been sort of like a 20th century Tolstoy quote of like, instead of, you know, all happy families are alike and all miserable families are unique in their misery,
yeah,
or opposite to that. So like all, I don't know, aspirational stories have a uniqueness to them. All stories of bottoming out are basically the same. So until I can figure out how to write the second book in a way that hasn't already been written, it will remain unwritten.
Yeah. Were you surprised in the writing process? Did the process itself, your ability to do it, surprise you?
Yeah, because I originally didn't want to write it. I wanted to do what most self-respecting musicians do, which is like tell the story to someone else and then take credit for it. Because that seemed like so much fun to like sit down once a week, with a nice journalist and tell them my story and have them write it down. And I would just drink tea and reminisce, and they would turn it into a great book. And I wouldn't really have to do that much. And then I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, you know, you're descended from Herman Melville. It would be a hereditary and literary affront to not write your own book.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was going to say a bad word, but we're recording this for your radio show, so I won't. Oh, rats. You're right.
Well, what impressed me was not just your sort of command of the narrative arc, but little details.
Go on.
You describe a bathroom in a bar in San Francisco as having an alphabet of hepatitis on the toilet.
By the way, I fought to keep that in.
I thought that was a brilliant phrase.
I was going to use, originally there was a much more obscure reference. I was going to say an abecedarian, because I thought an abecedarian was a noun describing like an ABC, and my editor told me that actually, no, I believe it's a person who would write ABC. But basically, abecedarian was taken out, but I was allowed to keep in an alphabet of hepatitis.
So in terms of the way the story is structured, we get the Moby who's sober. We get the Moby who's beginning a descent into a much darker place. We also get the Moby who is like kind of Christian, trying not to be judgmental about it, and then morphing into something else. So in the process of writing this book, you had to really kind of think through what you were going to say about your own relationship with Christianity and how you were going to write that, because you're not telling it to someone else. You're putting those words to paper. How difficult was that?
I don't know. I mean, so before writing the book, I went out and read as many music memoirs as I could get my hands on. And I found that most of them are not very good.
Right.
Some are amazing. Duff McKagan's is wonderful.
And actually, Patti Smith.
And I actually like Bob Dylan's Chronicles. Like, there's some really good ones. But I started recognizing some, like, shortcoming patterns in certain memoirs. And one of the failings seemed to be an unwillingness to be actually honest, you know, to present yourself in a more sort of banal, anodyne way, or to be like really solipsistic and self-involved. And then I read John Cheever's journals, and that, which might sound absurdly aspirational for like a first-time writer to like aspire, not even aspire towards writing like John Cheever, but I sort of thought if he could be that unflinchingly honest, at the very least I can aspire to be that unflinchingly honest. So I mean, it's uncomfortable. You know, there's a lot of very uncomfortable, honest stuff in the book, but it's human honest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a very serious 8-year relationship with Christianity. And then I sort of recognized, and I'm just speaking subjectively, how complicated the universe is, how old it is, how unknowable it is. And I just sort of realized, and it seems very self-evident now, that like, you can't, in this human form, you can't even begin to describe the architect of a 15 billion year old universe that's vast beyond our imagining. Like, it's the height of presumptuousness to say my idea of God is right and yours is wrong. Like, it's kind of the height of presumptuousness to even say, like, I have an idea of who or what God might be. What I realized for myself is that my Christianity, to an extent, was based on the teachings of Christ, which I still love, like stressing the virtues of forgiveness, compassion, humility, love, non-judgmentalism. Like, those are all great things. You don't necessarily have to turn an appreciation for those ideals into a dogmatic rigidity.
That's Moby. We recorded our conversation at the Barnes & Noble bookstore near Union Square in Manhattan, talking about his memoir called Porcelain. This piece is called God Moving Over the Face of the Waters.
Thank you.
From Moby, that's called God Moving Over the Face of the Waters, one of a handful of songs whose creation is described in Moby's new memoir. It's called Porcelain.
The book takes a dark turn towards a little bit past the middle.
Which is funny. So I've been doing some interviews about the book, and I can kind of tell when people haven't read the whole thing. Because they'll talk to me, they'll be like, so, in the book, you're a sober Christian. I was like, well, for half of it. Yeah, the later part, like the dominatrix, dating strippers, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like that, less so. So in about the middle of the book, and I don't know if I described it all that well, was this sort of realization that, like, to an extent, ethics can only be applied to actions that affect other people or other things. And so by that criteria, I think I led a relatively ethical life because it's only hurting myself,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's why I've been a vegan now for 28 years. So even like at the height of my crazy alcoholic drug taking degeneracy, I still couldn't break my veganism because by doing that, I felt like I was contributing to something that caused suffering for something else.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Absolutely, and it is one of the constants in the book. Another constant in the book, and really a character in the book, is New York City, at a time when it was a dark place, when mm-hmm. it, you know, had hit a kind of a low. And one of the striking things early in the book is just how joyful the young Moby is in this seedy, rundown, AIDS-infested, crack-addicted city of the early 90s.
Oh, it was great. it was... I mean, it's hard, I do have to sort of qualify that by saying, like, demographically, the New York of the 70s and the 80s into the 90s, you know, the drug-addicted, dangerous, AIDS-ravaged, crack-ravaged city, as a young white man, it was a nice place. I'm guessing as a, like, 8-year-old girl trying to walk to school, it wasn't so great. Or, like, a 75-year-old retired woman, it wasn't so great. But, like, for me, demographically, like, it was a relatively safe place, and it was super cheap. I mean, it's funny, New Yorkers, there's one detail in the book that New Yorkers seem to really relate to or respond to in a kind of angry way, is the fact that my first apartment on 14th and 3rd paid $185 a month for it. Yeah, everyone's like, oh. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about demographics because, you know, you came out of a punk rock background, but when you came to New York, you actually write early in the book, I dreamed of DJing in the dark. I mean, that took you into a world where a straight white man was a demographic minority.
Yeah, and it was so exciting and it was such an honor. And I don't mean this in some like Benetton-inspired PC way, but being the only straight white man in clubs filled with African-American, gay, Latino people. Like, it was such an honor. And there's, like, one scene in the book, scene, chapter. I live in L.A. It's scenes, you know. It's like, there's one chapter where I made a pilgrimage out to Newark to go to this nightclub, Zanzibar, where Tony Humphries DJed, and I was the only straight white man there. And I felt very honored to be let in, even though I was on the receiving end of racial epithets. You know, I remember this beautiful queen saying when I walked in, she looked at me and she said, so it's tonight Klan night, honey? And I was like, no, it's not. I understand. I'm a straight white guy in a gay African-American club. And then I got spit on a few times, but it didn't really bother me because I was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to be a part of that culture while the rest of my friends were, you know, I don't know, drinking domestic beer and talking about indie rock. And there's
right.
nothing wrong with domestic beer and indie rock, but at the time I was so much more excited by gay, black, Latino culture.
We'll be right back.
an early hit, his first hit. It's called Go from Moby. We're listening in to our conversation with Moby about his memoir, Porcelain, recorded at the Barnes & Noble bookstore on Union Square in Manhattan.
So how did it happen that your aspiration at a time when most would-be musicians wanted to form a band, how was it that your dream was DJing?
I don't know. I think it's a bigger question of, like, what utility does music have in our lives? And for me, the primary and most profound utility of music is its ability to convey emotion and to resonate with us emotionally. And when I discovered, because I grew up listening to punk rock and new wave, and I still love punk rock and new wave, but in around the early to mid 80s, when I discovered African American dance music and Latino dance music, there was a visceral, emotional quality to it that had been sort of missing from a lot of the music I'd grown up with. And on some very subjective, emotional level, it just woke me up. And I realized, especially when AIDS happened, the utility of music and culture in the gay African American community is something that didn't exist in the straight white community. You know, like, so if this is 1989 and the gay African American community was being ravaged by crack and AIDS, going to a club and dancing was not elective. Like, it was a form of refuge and safety, and like the celebration that you had in those times just like didn't exist in the white world.
You write in the book that, you know, there was a sense of joy in the all-night raves. And at some point, and it seemed like it happened with the turning of a calendar page, that changed. And this gets to something that I think a lot of people who look at electronic music have long complained about, which is like every month there's a different term, there's a different style. How do you keep up?
I mean, the genre thing, like, I'll go on Beatport. Beatport is a website for dance music, and I'll look at these genres, and I'm like, oh, I don't know what that means. Like, and you realize, like, one genre, if you listen to it, goes oomph, 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 oomph. And then you go to the other genre, it goes oomph, 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 oomph. Like, oh, okay, I'll look at the others, and I'll kind of go oomph, oomph, oomph. Like, it's all house music. Some of it's a little faster, some of it's a little slower, but it's basically, for the most part, all house music. So I don't worry about the genres too much. I mean, maybe that's because I'm old. If I was 22, I might be obsessed with the minutiae behind each genre. But
you write that in 93, you felt like a holdover from 92 or 91.
Oh, by 93, I felt like a has-been. Like, I felt like I jumped the shark in, like, 92. I remember DJing at this club in Tribeca that had been Area and B-Squared and Shelter, and I showed up wanting to play euphoric dance music, and the rave scene had already left me behind, like, in a week. Largely, I think it was because of a couple things. One was the drugs. When people were doing one or two hits of ecstasy a night, they were dancing and smiling and touching your face and telling you that they loved you, and it was great. I was just so nice. Like, I mean, even, like, I was sober back then, but it was still nice being surrounded by people on ecstasy. Like, who wouldn't like beautiful raver girls coming up and stroking your hair, and your, this is back when I had hair, stroking you and, like, just saying, like, oh, you're so beautiful, I love you. Like, even if you know it's chemically enhanced, it's still nice.
Yeah.
And then overnight, everyone started doing acid and Special K, and everything got dark. Like, the music got dark, the culture got dark, people would just pass out on dance floors. And it was interesting, but there was no joy anymore, at least not that I was aware of. And I think it also played into one other aspect that really bummed me out, is this sort of Calvinist legacy of distrust of joy. You know, like, I mean, we got to say, like, white people, like, celebration and joy is not our strong suit. You know, irony, cynicism, withdrawal, like, these are things we're really good at. And I think that's why I gravitated towards dance music. It was the opposite of that. And it made me very sad when dance music became academic and reserved in a way that I thought dance music was never supposed to be.
So not to be received with the arms folded, but with the arms wildly waving above your head.
I mean, I guess there's time to, like, fold your arms and nod your head and think. You know, nothing wrong with that. But, like, as long as it's balanced by joy and celebration and actual an outpouring of emotion.
Here we go!
One of the other things that we get during the course of the book, which I want to ask about in a minute, is, you know, we actually see the process of you writing some of your songs. But before I ask you too much about that, would you read a passage from the book for us?
Okay. Sure. This is my first ever reading. You guys are going to pop my reading cherry. See, you're clapping, but I haven't done it yet. It's kind of like giving a tip before you eat. Like, it might be terrible. I could just read the legal page. I was like, in 1989, I moved to an apartment on 14th and 3rd. I'm not reading, by the way. That would be really dull. So I'm just giving you a little backstory. So I moved to this apartment on 14th and 3rd, and I had a bunch of roommates. And I was born in New York in 1965. So in 1989, I'd finally returned home, I felt. So now I'm going to start reading. That wasn't reading. At 2 a.m., the housewarming party in our new apartment started winding down, so I turned on the lights and ended the night with a cassette of Night Moves by Bob Seger. I'm not going to read for a second. Just as an aside, if you're a DJ, by all means, you should play Bob Seger at the end of the night. Like, why not? You know Bob Seger? Night Moves? Such a great song. Like, every DJ should have a Bob Seger record somewhere in their collection. My drunk friends sang along, finished their beers, and headed home. I went to bed and set my alarm for 7 a.m. so I could wake up and collect all the empty cans and bottles before anyone threw them away. After I slept for a few hours, I woke up at dawn and filled 3 garbage bags with bottles and cans and lugged them down 14th Street to the food emporium. Even early in the morning, there were a dozen homeless people standing in line outside the supermarket, all waiting to use the recycling machines. It was a cold March morning. I was wearing a Vietnam-era army jacket, thrift shop jeans, old work boots, and a black knit cap pulled over my head. It was starting to drizzle. My plastic garbage bag smelled like beer, and the people walking in and out of the food emporium were giving me and the homeless people in line pitying looks. When it was my turn, I patiently inserted my bottles and cans into the recycling machines. Each time, I was rewarded with a loud crunch and 5 cents that clattered into the metal tray. After a few minutes, my bags were empty and my pockets were full of nickels. I had made $5 in loose change and I felt rich. All I'd done was wake up early and collect garbage that would have been thrown away. I'd put the garbage into a machine and the machine had given me money. I felt like an alchemist, but instead of turning lead into gold, I'd turned beer bottles into nickels. It was 9 a.m. and I was newly rich with nickels, so I headed for Prana Health Foods on First Avenue. Prana was the only health food store in my new neighborhood, and it hadn't changed since 1970. It smelled like oats and brewer's yeast and stale spinach, and everyone who worked there was surly and thin and looked like a refugee from a Grateful Dead show parking lot. They even had the requisite hippie cat sleeping on the bulk sesame seed bin. I splurged on my favorite luxury indulgence, vanilla soy milk, which was $1.49 per carton. While the cranky hippie behind the counter watched, I counted out $4.90 in nickels and bought 3 containers of vanilla soy milk and an organic orange. Now I was an alchemist twice over. I'd turned beer cans and bottles into soy milk and an orange. I walked up First Avenue and got home just as my roommates were waking up. My roommate Roberto was staggering around the kitchen in his Calvin Klein underpants and Adidas sandals hung over. "You cleaned up?" he asked, confused. "I took all the bottles and cans to the recycling place at Food Emporium," I said proudly. "Ha, you're like a homeless dude," he said. I wanted to brag that I now had 3 cartons of soy milk and an organic orange, but his family owned a villa in Provence, so I didn't think he'd be impressed. Yo, what was that whack rock track you played at the end of the party, he asked. Night Moves by Bob Seger, I asked. That, NPR, that crap is whack. I wanted to defend Bob Seger, but said nothing. I just put away my groceries. Roberto had grown up in New York, and he understood cool things in a way that I never would. We were both DJs, but he loved obscure jazz and Cozy Burger, and I loved Bob Seger and soy milk. Yo, can I have some of your orange, Roberto asked. My orange. It had cost 40 cents, or 8 cans. Okay, I said, it's organic. As opposed to synthetic, he asked. I peeled the orange, and we sat down on our stained futon to play Mario Brothers on the Nintendo. Are you DJing at Mars tonight, he asked. Yeah, in the basement. Clark Kent's on the main floor, and Red Alert's on the second floor. Word, can you put me on the list? Sure, you plus 2? Yeah, thanks, he said. We sat on the futon, eating my organic orange and watching Mario leap around on giant mushrooms. I looked at the gray tenement wall across the shaftway from our apartment and I smiled. For the first time since 1967, I was a New Yorker.
I just want to say, when I first started learning how to play the guitar, C, F, and G.
Yeah.
That's night. I found myself playing Night Moves, and my brother would not let me hear the he's playing Night Moves, you know? Like, there's something wrong with learning how to play a song on the guitar, but it's...
Yep, I was listening to Bob Seger just the other day, unapologetically, non-ironically.
Yeah.
It was great.
Is it that you remember details like what you were wearing that morning?
Well, clothes thing, I didn't have that many clothes. So it was pretty easy. Some of it's remembering, some of it's just assumption. Like, I was probably wearing jeans because I've never really not worn a pair of jeans, yeah. You know, except for like funerals and parties that I have to get dressed up for. So, but there's this odd thing, and I don't... it's going to sound pretentious, but it's kind of like this Proustian mnemonic process where, like, you remember a room from 20, 30, 40 years ago, and then you start populating it with things that you specifically remember. And by doing that, there's almost like this neurochemical cascade of, like, the room just populates itself, and the memories start cascading, like, you know, Proust with his Madeleine... It's like me with my futon and Mario Brothers.
And even during the years where you're drinking heavily and blacking out and waking up in your own vomit, there's still incredible detail there.
I mean, here's the other thing, because I've been asked about that. Like, how did I remember everything? There's a chance I didn't. I mean, like, memory, you know, it's like Nabokov. Like, my memory was speaking. It doesn't mean it's accurate.
Okay.
You know, like, it's quite possible that someone's going to come to me and say, like, are you kidding? I was there. None of this happened. And I'm like, but this is what I remember.
That's why it's a memoir.
Yeah.
You know? It's one person's memories. So the process of songwriting. The interesting thing is, you know, we get, like, 4 or 5 case studies. Go.
Mm-hmm. Feeling So Real.
Feeling So Real.
God,
Why Does My Heart
Water
Feel So Bad?
Why Does My Heart, yeah.
They all end up at some point revolving around sampled sound, either samples that you can use or, in one case, a sample that you couldn't use. So where do you stand on the big picture of art eating itself, you know, of recycling and reusing other people's material?
Well, I mean, to some extent, unless someone is just singing, you are availing yourself of someone else's creative work. What I mean by that is, like, if I'm a guitar player, I'm playing a guitar that someone else built. I'm playing wood that someone else grew. I'm playing strings that someone else designed and made. So we all have to come after someone else's creative work.
I guess the word that often gets used in legal proceedings is transformative. You know, what have you done to transform the person, yeah. place, or thing that you've appropriated. And, you know, it seems like a well-done song built around a sample will transform that sample.
And I personally just like to ignore the legal side. I would...
And how's that worked out for you?
Sometimes okay. I think it's that ethos of, like, it's just better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yep, yep.
In most things, you know. But, like, if I get sued, I get sued. But I'd rather make a piece of music and get sued for making it than be cautious and not make it in the first place, you know. The world is, I think, a richer place for having... let's call like messy copyright around music than lawsuits. You know, the world benefits far more from music than most copyright lawsuits.
Why does my heart feel so bad? Why does my soul feel so bad? Why does my heart feel so bad? Why does my soul feel so bad? Why does my heart?
Your early life is sketched kind of in retrospect in the book. It hasn't been like descent to sobriety and then, or let's say ascent to sobriety and then descent into alcohol and drugs. It's been up and down and up and down several times.
Yeah, in my cult of Alcoholics Anonymous, we refer to that as revolving door sobriety. And I've been through the revolving door many, many times. I'm hoping in the interest of staying alive and being able to string sentences together that this bout of sobriety will actually last. Yeah. At this point in my life, the thing that I'm most grateful for is the perspective that I have. And perspective is sort of by definition the cumulative effect of everything you've experienced. So if you're grateful for the perspective you have, you can't necessarily... not be grateful or not have gratitude for the things that have contributed to that perspective. So even though very many unpleasant things have happened to all of us and to me, I can't say that I wish that they hadn't happened because I'm grateful for where I am right now. I mean, of course, if someone gave me a pill that would make me 6'1" with a full head of hair, I would take it without even thinking. But until they invent the magic, like the pill that will turn me into Hugh Jackman, I'm just going to have to be like a short, bald, middle-aged guy who's kind of happy to be alive.
That is Moby, as we recorded him at the Barnes & Noble bookstore on Union Square in Manhattan. His memoir is called Porcelain. It is out now. That's going to do it for this episode of the Soundcheck Podcast. There's lots more on our website, our daily gig alerts, our weekly music roundups, and of course, our regular podcasts of live in-studio performances, videos, and more. That's at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.